Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I had a rare occasion to go into public this week. I actually had a nice dinner with my childhood best friend's father, who is a sports maniac. He's totally into rugby, so our Australian friends can get excited about that. And you know, he was just asking me how life is going. And I said, you know, I've actually spent about the last 2.5 to 3 weeks of my life chained to a computer, making predictions and outlines for what could happen or might happen or very well might not happen in the upcoming NBA season, all of which will be completely pointless come October 17th, once the season starts and all the storylines immediately change. And he looked over at me and he's like, why do you do that? And I didn't have an answer, Andrew. Why do we do this? Why do we preview the NBA in such detail only to be likely proven wrong next week?
You're living the dream, man. You know, don't sell yourself short. This is what a lot of people would love to be doing, and you're doing it. And I also like
I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. I'm just his question stumped me. I'm not totally sure why we do exactly what we've been doing. I mean, if you go back and think about what we've been talking about, we've been excited about all 30 teams in the league. We've been down on all 30 teams in the league. We've talked about it so long. We've gone in circles. You've taken my takes. I've taken your takes. You're now a Sixers fan. I don't know how that happened. I mean, we might be suffering from paralysis of information. That's all I'm saying.
There's no question that we have way too much time on our hands. But today, things are actually a little tight because I'm going to the Nationals game. So we got to be quick today. Keep it to like a tight hour. And then I can go watch the Nats lose, but which will be great. So let's
keep it to a trim hour 45, our specialty.
Yeah. Just warning you at the outset, Ben. All right. So let's jump in. We didn't finish from the last podcast our three teams to ignore. So who are your three teams to ignore this year?
Well, you go first. You carried the last podcast. I'm going to let you carry it again.
Well, no.
Who's on your hate list? Go for it.
I'm honestly more curious for yours just because you're a journalist. You're responsible. And I feel like it's probably pretty difficult for you to admit that you don't watch all 30 teams. So I'm waiting and I'm anxious and excited to hear what you have to say. But I'll say this. My three teams, I'm not including the Bulls because the Bulls is just too easy, but the Bulls roster right now is just a disaster. I mean, it's like Robin Lopez is legitimately the best player on their team. Lauri Markkanen, Chris Dunn is actually, Chris Dunn looked okay, and now he's hurt, which is super depressing. So they are going to be worse than I think anyone even realizes, like 12-win type team. The bad team that I included was the Knicks. I'm out on all Knicks games this year. Not enough has been said about the New York Knicks starting Ramon Sessions at point guard this season.
I agree with that statement. Not enough has been said about that. And I don't think very much will be said about it. So I'm not going to admit that I don't watch anyone. I generally look at the question you're posing here as who am I going to hate watch the most? Like who is just going to make me really dig deep into like the sadomasochistic parts of my brain when I tune into them. Sacramento is right there for me. I mean, I like Fox. I'm with you on Fox. I think everyone would agree he's going to be a few years away. Their roster construction drives me crazy. I'm not nearly as high on some of their prospects as a lot of people. I got into a big, debate with Kevin Pelton and Danny LaRue on a pod recently about how excited they are for guys like Scal and Harry Giles. And I'm just not. And their old guys are depressing. And when you really watch them, they're struggling to score like 70 points in the preseason. And you know how I feel about Buddy. So they're right there for me. This also kind of goes back, though, to the treadmill of mediocrity. Everyone always says, oh, you don't want to be stuck in the middle in the NBA. And that's the worst place to be because you'll never win a title. It's better to bottom out and all of that. Yeah. I think the treadmill of mediocrity actually applies for watchability, too, because you get teams like Detroit. I don't think Detroit's going to be atrocious, but that is going to be a tough watch. I mean, no matter how you slice it, that
Detroit
is not going to be a team.
Detroit is a great, great nomination for a team to ignore. And speaking of mediocrity, my next one is the Toronto Raptors. I'm just out on the Raptors at this point. We've seen them have the exact same year for the last three seasons now, and I just don't need to watch this play out all over again. I don't need the DeRozan hype. I don't need the Kyle Lowry hype. And then the late season nagging injuries and the playoff disappointments. Like, I'd rather see if the Bucks can put it together. I'd rather see another team in the East try to rise. The Heat are so much more fun than the fucking Raptors at this point. So with all due respect, not that much respect, I'm out on the Raptors.
Yeah, there's a fine line between familiar and stale. I definitely think Toronto has crossed that line. And when I look at the Raptors, they've tried to get out in front of this. I mean, kudos to Dwayne Casey. He clearly consulted with the branding expert because he tried to get out in front of all of this, oh, they're boring, same old team talk, by overhauling his offense and focusing more on ball movement, three-pointers, and so forth. I think there's a very strong chance that it doesn't really go that smoothly, and then the major players on that roster just revert to their preferred tendencies, and then it gets right back into the stale category with the added tension of like, hey, this wasn't how it was supposed to go. Why are we doing this? Kind of back and forth stuff that could get pretty depressing all around. So I'm with you. Also, they're playing tons of young guys. I actually think the baby Raptors bench has sneaky watchability just because they have a bunch of weird youngsters who are going to have to play more minutes.
Who are we talking about, though?
I mean, you can go from Poeltl to Bebe. I'm not sure Caboclo is going to really get in that much. They got Van Vliet. Just a bunch of random young guys because they lost Corey Joseph. They lost like half their rotation so that they could secure the big three.
Those are
basically
not the
anyone besides their starters are under 24. Yeah, they're weird. I mean, Pascal is kind of interesting. They're just new. They're new, quantities, basically unproven quantities. And that's what I get excited about sometimes, is just something that I've never seen before.
All right. Give me another team you're ignoring this year.
Well, I hate to say it. I think Memphis might be in that category. I like them. I think the franchise has done a remarkable job of kind of like churning out postseason performances year after year. I love watching Conley. I love watching the interplay between Conley and Marc Gasol.
Well, like, here's what I'd say. You're
not excited about the Grizzlies.
You're
get out of
Mr.
here.
Mr. George Hill and Mr. Mike Conley, and you're turning your back on both of them with these picks. I'm with you. Look, Grizzlies games. Experience is actually a lot of fun in the arena, but watching them, they don't bring a lot to the table. And the Kings, I mean, the Kings are a tough sell any year. So I don't disagree. I just feel like
See, that's the thing. You're just confusing everybody. This is why we're constantly getting emails from people who don't understand where I stand on things, because you're always blurring the lines, fake news. You can respect a player. You can respect a player without enjoying the experience of watching him. And in fact, to reach enlightenment as a basketball fan and as a basketball observer, you need to work a little bit harder on getting to that level. Okay? That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. That's why I do this podcast, to be told I need to work harder. It's a recurring theme from you.
Look, I'm saying I really appreciate and respect Mike Conley, right? Is he appointment viewing for me? No. Am I going to watch a lot of his games? Yes. Am I going to enjoy what the Grizzlies are doing when they've lost half their identity? Granted, some guys who are, past their prime, they haven't had a single three-pointer made from Chandler Parsons in the entire preseason. They're plugging and playing a whole bunch of just sort of like reclamation projects, whether it's Tyreek Evans or Ben McLemore, any of these guys. Like, it's not going to be a fun watch, but I still respect what they're doing and their organization's direction. You can have it both ways.
The Grizzlies are boring enough so that a lot of people have probably turned off the podcast in the last 90 seconds. So we can move on. Give me your last team.
Well, just to be clear, I led off with a fascinating antidote of a conversation I had with a person in real life. You brought up the most boring teams to watch as your first topic.
Don't
so don't blame me when people are tuning out.
Give me your final team.
I think I've already given you three.
Okay.
Haven't I? Sacramento, Detroit, and Memphis. I mean, we can talk about why Detroit's like going to the dentist. I mean, that's basically what it boils down to. You know, Reggie Jackson is the drill in your mouth. I mean, that is just who he is as a player and as a person, as a leader.
That's so mean.
Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. Reggie Jackson was at Boston College when I was at Boston College. So I have always had a soft spot for him and have been rooting for him every step of the way. And for a long time, I could not figure out why the entire NBA seems to hate Reggie Jackson. But you're right that if you watch Pistons games and watch him sort of do his thing, where he dribbles for 15 seconds and takes like a bad 19-footer, it's a tough sell. And it seems like his teammates were trying to sort of stage a mutiny at points last year. And I can't believe that they're actually bringing everybody back this year. And I also can't believe that the East is bad enough that like the Pistons are probably favored to make the playoffs at this point.
So there's people out there who like the irrational confidence guys, like the brash guys, like the personality.
You're describing
the cult of personality. I can't stand those guys because they don't have an accurate self-assessment. And that's Reggie Jackson. Even Reggie Jackson at his peak was only about 50% as good as Reggie Jackson thinks Reggie Jackson is. And that's a serious problem. Okay. And when I look at the rest of their roster, like I can kind of get excited about Tobias Harris. I can kind of talk myself into, Avery Bradley, really solid, quality, two-way contributor. I can't wait to see what he does in a new organization. But that's like getting excited about the free floss and toothpaste when you go to the dentist. You still have to pay the price and take that drill.
The dentist analogy. I'm with you, man. You're not going to get any argument from me. I think you overdid it a little bit with the self-assessment bullshit that you threw in there. But beyond that, I agree. My final team, it's a longer story. I had the Warriors in here as the team that I'm just not interested in. I know. But I really mean it. I mean it. And like,
dude,
Warriors Rockets on opening night, I don't really care about that game. I just can't get excited to watch Warriors games. And a quick story. I was on the beach this summer. And I was talking to an older guy. He's like a family friend, and he was like, we started talking about basketball, and he's like, "What do you think about the Warriors?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And then he says, "Well, I'm a fan of the Warriors. I appreciate greatness." And that's what a lot of people say about this team, and it fucking annoys me because I appreciate greatness too. The problem with Warriors games is that for most of the games, they are not really engaged. Like, they don't have to play well to beat teams by 20. And it just gets pretty repetitive after a while.
You're spoiled, Rod. You're spoiled.
No, absolutely. I'm not.
Rod.
Go back
to 2004 and try to, sit through some games then. This is what we lived for, Andrew. We've been waiting a decade to see this level of brilliance, and casual brilliance is still brilliance.
I guess I would rather them be in a situation where there's like a credible threat to force them to play as well as they could. But for the most part, most Warriors games are those guys kind of go through the motions, and it's boring. However, this afternoon, about an hour before we started recording this podcast, I saw a Draymond Green interview with GQ. Have you seen this interview yet?
No, I haven't. And honestly, I'm getting to the point where I'm pretty angry. So you're going to need to stop asking rhetorical questions, or I'm just going to use those pauses in the conversation back at you right now.
Let me tell you something. It's too early in the year for us to be arguing about the Warriors. I'm just telling you how I feel, and I'm telling you that I read this Draymond Green interview and completely reverse course, and I am willing to tolerate the Warriors.
Thank you.
So, he said, he's talking to Clay Skipper of GQ. He says, "It's so funny sitting back and watching this shit." By the way, not safe for work for all of Draymond's quotes here. He says, and then he pauses to pull out his phone, looking through the Warriors group chat. The team has one, and then there's also a group chat for the Hamptons Five, which is Draymond, Steph, Klay Thompson, Iguodala, and Kevin Durant. And then he wants, apparently he sent out the Daryl Morey quote to the group chat where Morey says, "They are not unbeatable. There have been bigger upsets in sports history. We are going to keep improving our roster. We are used to long odds. If Golden State makes the odds longer, we might up our risk profile and get even more aggressive. We have something up our sleeve." Then Draymond pauses, scoffing at Morey's comments. "What the fuck are you talking about?" he says. "They really are trying to rethink their whole strategy." And then he bumps the table with his hand for emphasis. "Because teams know they don't have a fucking clue." And then he starts talking about the finals and he says, "It's pretty fucking sick to see how everybody is just in a fucking panic about what to do. You sit back and think, like, these motherfuckers, they know. That's the fun part about it. They know they don't stand a chance." And so that interview brought me back. And there's a lot more on GQ. Draymond brought me back. I will have fun with the Warriors this year, regardless.
Good, because first of all, the other 29 teams are the teams that are not as entertaining as the Warriors. The Warriors are on that level, and maybe they don't get pushed as often as you would want, but when they do get pushed, there's nothing better in basketball. Houston, Oklahoma City, and a whole bunch of other teams, I'd even include Cleveland, spent their summers positioning themselves to push Golden State harder. And honestly, Draymond, let's go back 2 years to the finals when you probably had the exact same feelings that you had right now, and you sat out and you missed a game because of a stupid suspension. You cost your team a title.
I'm not here for Draymond lectures today, okay? I'm not. But I will say that this is a much better way to frame the Warriors. Like, if they're sitting there mocking the rest of their league and mocking these teams who spent the summer, like, moving heaven and earth to maybe get a game off them in the playoffs, I'm in for all of that. It's this, the idea that this isn't crazy and that the rest of the league isn't helpless, that's where I start to roll my eyes. But if they're going to talk shit through the next 3 years, that we'll be able to have fun with it.
You will never, ever find me saying a team that wins 70 games is boring. And they have a chance to win 70, and I'm almost offended by your original opinion, and I'm very, very glad you came back to the good side.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to some mail, because we've got to talk Sixers as well. This is from Frieder. He says, "Ben totally botched the chance to turn the Embiid contract into a victory lap. I think the main reason why the Sixers signed him so early is it was an attempt to reestablish loyalty. The Thunder model, because the Thunder model of building through the draft is indeed dead, just like Ben said. And for the process to actually work, the Sixers have to get some sort of commitment from the players. I think they tried to humanize the rather mathematical and cold process, and it might turn out to be really smart." What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, they definitely went too far on the dehumanization side. I think you don't need to look any further than Nerlens Noel, Jahlil Okafor, or KJ McDaniels to kind of get that vibe, right? Like, there was a lot of people who just were saying, "I'm out." But I think in the specific case of Embiid, the loyalty factor that you're trying to put together, you're trying to lock in a guy you can count on. And everybody would agree. You can't count on this guy to be healthy for the next year of his rookie contract plus five more years of an extension. So you're not really getting the benefits of that attempt at loyalty. You're really just sort of, you know, put yourself in a risky situation. I also think Embiid was really in no position to go anywhere else, was he? I mean, not only could they match any contract, but wouldn't that be basically impossible to overcome if he tries to force his way out of Philadelphia after sitting or missing time, stretching certain injuries, you know, to kind of be ultra careful, never really delivering, cashing $20 million off his rookie deal? I think that would have basically been untenable. The loyalty thing would have come back on him, I think, much harder than it would have Philadelphia. So I kind of get what he's saying in terms of you want to rebuild the culture and show maybe guys like Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz, you're going to do right by them because you also did right by Embiid. Yeah. I just don't know if they needed to do that here.
Yeah, and I think that's not exactly what happened. I think the Sixers were looking to protect themselves because they assume that somebody like Chicago next summer could give him $150 million. And they just wanted to be careful. And we covered a lot of that earlier this week. The one thing that I wonder, watching that game last night, you saw highlights of Embiid, right?
I watched his every minute that he played, basically.
I mean,
yeah.
He was a monster. And we've talked about not putting stock into the preseason. Almost every Embiid highlight was him against Trevor Booker. So I'm not going to like turn him into Wilt Chamberlain today. But I was watching that. And if he's healthy for 60 games, he might really make first team all NBA and turn this into a $175 million deal.
It's not impossible, but I think that it's really important to try to think like a computer on this one, because that was such an amazing performance, such an emotional performance, such a long-awaited performance that it's so
awesome.
Easy to allow the emotions to take over. I will admit, for about 3.6 seconds, I got swept up in it as well. But if you look at like Embiid's career as like 1,000 simulations, right? Like, in how many of those simulations is he going to just dominate Trevor Booker? You know what I mean? And then in how many of those simulations is he going to go on to be dominant in his first month of the season, and then go on to be dominant in his second month of the season? And you know, at some point, those simulations are going to go awry, sort of like his last 3 years have, and he's going to, you know, potentially miss time with this, get nicked up with this, small injury, big injury, season-ending injury, can't play back-to-backs, whatever it might be, there's going to be hurdles. And I'm hoping, just like everyone else, that he makes it through scot-free this year. And, I mean, the guy that we saw on the court is not a guy we should be starting his benchmark at 50 games, right? I mean, that looked like a guy whose his benchmark should be 75, right? I mean, he didn't look limited physically really in any way.
Yeah, he's a little heavy right now. And he again played like 15 minutes, and the minutes limit aspect, we forget, like he never played more than 26 or 27 minutes a game last year, and that limits teams too. So it's not just that he's like he can't play back to backs. It's hard. Like, they need a real backup center who's going to play significant minutes because of Embiid.
I guess my point is, you can't really judge the risks that are involved here off of one game, or even off one month,
or even off one season. I'm just saying.
No, I know. I'm just trying to get people to pump the brakes a little bit, because that is basically the decision that Philadelphia had to take, right? And I'm sure there's a lot of them feeling like a real sigh of relief after that first game of like, yep. Like, this is our guy. You know, he's showing that he can do it. And the percentages over the course of that many years for a guy with his injury history, it's dicey. But look, it was very easy to celebrate that. And I was really excited to read your piece today, because you delved into the emotional aspects of it. And I think you should talk a little bit about what you heard from Brett Brown about the Embiid effect, or some of his teammates about the Embiid effect that's happening in Philadelphia, because everybody saw it on display if they watched that preseason game.
Yeah, well, the funny thing with Embiid is his contract, like, now that we know the details of the clauses and everything, it really captures the whole story, because he totally could make $175 million and make first-team All-NBA. And then, I mean, it's just as plausible that he re-injures his foot or his back or whatever the specific injuries are, and they waive him. Although I don't know if they'd really have the balls to go through and waive him. But my time with the Sixers, it's funny, because Embiid is, he sort of exceeds the hype in person. Like, most people, especially in the NBA, most people, like, Russ is not as cool in person as you would imagine. And like most stars are just kind of buttoned up and not, they don't live up to their persona, whereas Embiid is actually more ridiculous and more entertaining and endearing. So he was great. But it's also, I love talking to like all those guys, like Dario Saric. I didn't really have much room for him in the piece, but he was fantastic talking about how much he loves Philly, and he compared all the players to puzzle pieces and says that this year we make the same beautiful basketball picture, and it was just the best. The two guys that I wanted to talk to you about that I didn't really have time to get into in the article today were Markelle Fultz and Ben Simmons. What do you think is going on with Fultz?
Before we get to those two guys, can you fact check me that you didn't mention Jahlil Okafor's name in your entire piece? Is that true?
I didn't, and our
editor... That's so perfect. I loved it. I loved it. No, it's so funny because we were way out in front on that in terms of like him not really being a part of the team at all. Like, he's not in the pictures. He's not in the bench. And then did you see his interview this week where he's just like, yeah, no, I don't even know if I'm a part of the team. Like, they made up this Feds nickname and there's no O in Feds. And it was like, well, this is...
I didn't see that. That's sad. Tough. That's tough. No, honestly, so my editor, Matt Dollinger, your editor too, he hit me up like late this morning and was like, do you not want to have Okafor in the piece? But I had already cut so many different quotes from like Saric and like Brett Brown. I could listen to that dude explain coaching and life, and like he had a long soliloquy about like the basketball scene in Philadelphia, and none of that stuff made the piece. So I was just like, look, if all the guys that I like aren't going to fit, then like I don't give a shit about trying to include Okafor. Just because he's been dealt a rough hand, but he's also been kind of mopey and like hard to root for the last couple of years. So I think it's just best for both sides in that one to have him move on.
I mean, when I look at Brett Brown, I actually see the leading candidate for the next White House chief of staff. I mean, I think what he's been through is perfect preparation for that job in terms of the thanklessness and long hours.
He deserves something better.
No, look, I'm really jealous of him because he got through to you about Ben Simmons, and I've been trying to get through to you about Ben Simmons for a year and a half. But the Okafor thing... It's fascinating. Like, he went vegan. I love that all the NBA guys are going vegan. It's about time they come around. I mean, you know, animal slaughterers like yourself are eventually going to see the light on this one, and you'll come to the good side there. But Okafor looks like a transformed guy. In terms of his body, I'm not sure he's really going to do much on the court this season. But he does kind of look like a trade piece for them now, which is interesting.
He looks good. That's all that matters.
Yeah. But in terms of Simmons and Fultz, you know where I stand. I think Simmons is going to be first or second in Rookie of the Year. I think he's going to be a matchup nightmare for other teams constantly. I think he's going to be able to get by okay on the other end. There's going to be lots of struggles. I love the predicaments that his pairing with a guy like Embiid creates. I mean, there's just not a lot of combos like that anywhere in the league. I think his vision's outstanding. I think he's very good at collapsing defenses, getting deep into the paint, setting guys up for drive and kick stuff. And just he's going to get you efficient shots, even though he's not a good shooter. Mm-hmm. In terms of Fultz, I have no idea what's going on there. Obviously, the videos are incredibly freaky of his shooting motion. And I guess at this point, my expectations were always fairly low for him just because I thought he was going to be kind of down the pecking order in terms of who eats first on that team. And I guess that has been reinforced by the preseason.
Yeah. Well, I think it's almost healthier for them to understand going in that Fultz is going to be more of a bit player this year. The Simmons side of this is interesting. It helps to talk to someone like Brett Brown, who actually like knows what he's talking about and understands basketball, because
opposed to me, is that what you're saying?
No, as opposed to me, because I've been sitting here for 2 years comparing him to Rajon Rondo, and I'm not willing to like back off that entirely. But Brett Brown was dead on with the three things that they're emphasizing are, one, he's got to be elite defensively, and the Sixers are pretty confident that he's going to be great on that end, and I'm not sure how much evidence there really is to support that, but if he is, that sort of like raises his baseline right there. And then as far as offense, Brett Brown was talking about he needs to, they're working on finishing and they're working on his free throws. And if he can get to the line and make free throws, and if he can finish at the rim, then he's going to affect the game in a lot of the same ways that Giannis does, where like he's such a matchup problem and he can get easy looks at the rim that it doesn't totally matter whether he can hit from the outside. And anyone who saw Simmons shoot one of the ugliest floaters I've seen in like the last decade last night against the Nets, like, it's going to be a process in terms of even just developing that like mid-range game and finishing at the rim, because I think like he doesn't really have a ton of confidence in that right now. But if he gets there, then I will be proven wrong and you will be proven right on Ben Simmons, and he's going to be a problem.
5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. And guys, not only that, while we're doing plugs, go read Andrew's piece on SI.com, okay? We're not just podcasters. We actually do write, and it's a pretty good piece. It talks about Simmons, like he just mentioned, gets into Fultz, really digs deep into the emotional impact of Embiid, like I said. So don't just give us those 5-star reviews, which we do appreciate. Go give Andrew a click, too.
One more thing. We've talked too much about the Sixers. Our resolution for the beginning of basketball season is to move beyond the Sixers. But I do want to say 30 seconds on Fultz. As someone who was a Fultz believer coming into the draft and coming into the summer and like really looked at like them adding Fultz was a big reason I sort of flipped on the Sixers in general, just because it was a really smart move. And now the shot is so bad that I'm not actually concerned. Like, it's so ridiculous that there's no way it's going to be this much of an issue for his career. Like, I would be a lot more concerned about Simmons's. The thing that I think should worry Sixers people is that he's now has like this nagging shoulder that Brett Brown has said is like contributing to the shooting. And then he had an ankle injury in Vegas. He had knee soreness at Washington that was like kind of vague. We're not sure exactly what happened. He had a knee injury in high school. So I doubt anyone in Philadelphia wants to worry more about injuries, but like, I think the realistic trajectory for Fultz is going to be like, the best case here would be to say like he'll be sort of like a Bradley Beal type, where it's going to take a couple years for him to take care of his body and develop, and then there are going to be a lot of people shitting on him in the meantime, saying that he's a bust and that they should have taken Lonzo and whatever. And like, I think 2 or 3 years down the line, he could break out and be awesome and be the guy that they expected him to be.
Yeah, you said the best case scenario, and I really thought you were about to say red shirt his rookie year. You didn't say that.
I did.
Also, you did not stick to the 30-second time limit you self-imposed.
Well, I have
and
some Fultz
you
thoughts,
did,
man.
You did not roll with my transition after I so carefully plugged your story to like get out of the Sixers talk. We've been talking about them for half an hour, and we have a lot of important things, you know, Utah National Parks, all these other great questions to get to, and we're still stuck on the Philadelphia 76ers.
You're right. It's time to move beyond the Sixers to the Brooklyn Nets.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. This is probably the second Nets question we've gotten in the last 2 years. Peter says, the Nets hype train is just getting going, so I'm giving you one last chance to jump on before we hit the next stop. Playoffs. And then he says, honestly, watch some of their preseason games. When they're playing well, it's a thing of beauty, and I'm sure Ben will find Spencer Dinwiddie supplanting Patty Mills in his heart in pretty short order. So to that end, what has to break right for the Nets to make the playoffs? I mean, not that much. It's the East. Like, there are 8 awful teams, so the Nets could absolutely make the playoffs.
I don't see them as a playoff team. I mean, they do have a fascinating collection of basically, like, salary cap cloggers. Like, Mozgov, Damari Carroll, Alan Crabb is, like, a pretty epic trio of just, like, deals you never thought would be traded that managed to get traded, and they're all going to be able to line up simultaneously. Like, that's pretty impressive.
Can we talk about that for a second? Why did the Nets people love Sean Marks and like the Nets patient strategy here, and they're like fighting it out and making smart deals. I don't understand why they traded for Alan Crabb.
I mean, people like Sean Marks because they pity Sean Marks. You know,
that's
it's
fair.
A thankless job. They're 5 years from relevance. He still has to show up every day. I mean, I've seen some valiant efforts in terms of, you know, stories written about you know, their culture and this and that. And they don't have that A-list prospect that you like can, you know, dangle on the horizon like a Joel Embiid and say like, hey, it's all going to be worth it. Like even in a best case scenario, D'Angelo Russell is not going to be worth it. You know,
yeah.
It's not going to be enough to like stick through the tough times. And so
for the record, though, Sean yeah. Marks is making a lot of money and he's living in Brooklyn. And I don't pity Sean Marks, because I think one of the hardest parts about being a GM is that I wouldn't want to live in like 20 or 25 NBA cities. But living in Brooklyn and running a basketball team sounds fucking great. And so he also has absolutely no pressure to produce for like the first 5 years of his tenure up there.
Yeah, and I think you can say that about basically all of his players. Like, there's a reason why they're happy. They're making millions of dollars and nobody cares at all. It's like, you know, no one's going to get mad at them. And if they disappoint again, I guess the takeaway here is, Peter, you know, fantastic optimism. Good luck with it. We'll see how it goes. If everything comes together beautifully, all of these guys completely overperform, they could absolutely be roadkill for a team that matters. And yes. Until then, we'll just wait. I don't know. That's
look.
When I said transition from the Sixers, I didn't mean to the team they killed in the preseason. I meant to any other team that matters. Pick any of them, Andrew.
What I'm trying to tell you right here, and this could be us having too much time on our hands, but I'm looking at the Nets roster. Jeremy Lin, D'Angelo Russell, Caris LeVert, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, there are enough pieces. Like, they're not that much more depressing than a team like the Pistons, so it's not inconceivable that they would make a little run here in the god awful East. But
the point is that shouldn't matter, because we should have the top 16 teams in the playoffs. We should not be in a situation where we're forced to squint and talk ourselves into this Nets team as a potential playoff team, because they're not even close to one of the 16 best teams in the conference. And we should not spend any mental energy trying to determine who's going to be like 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th in the East. It's a completely pointless exercise.
Okay. Well, there's our Nets question. We'll check back in 6 months. Jason says, as a Celtics fan, this IT and Danny Ainge beef has me pretty conflicted. On one hand, Isaiah did so much for us last year, even with the tragic things going on in his life. But I honestly think we're better off without him, thanks to the Kyrie trade and the rest of this offseason. Am I wrong? Is IT right? Is he taking this way too personally? And of course, he's referring to the comments Isaiah made to our own Lee Jenkins in this week's SI story. So what do you think?
Well, I think Jason is a fascinating case study here, because you can actually kind of taste and sense the distancing effect here. No, the distancing, because he's like, yeah, he did so much for us, but I think we're better off. You know, like if you had pulled Jason and 100 Celtics fans in like May and said, is there any scenario where you'll be okay with an Isaiah trade this summer? Like 99 would have said no trade under any circumstances, right?
Yeah.
Fast forward 3 months, the entire perception has changed. So I think given that, Isaiah is well within his right to have any level of scorn or frustration towards the Celtics franchise, no question.
Yeah,
I think it is part of the business. And I think he knows that. And I think he's playing it up a little bit, don't you?
Yeah. What Isaiah said to Lee Jenkins was along the lines of, I don't talk to Danny Ainge. I don't ever want to speak to Danny Ainge again. And I think he is reasonable to look at what he accomplished up there and be like, I'm out. I'm out on that guy for life. The other side of this, though, I totally understand where the Celtics are coming from. And it made sense for them to move on, and it was brutal, but it's one of those things where you just sort of have to charge it to the game. Like, it was best for Boston, certainly. And Isaiah, I mean, loyalty works both ways. Like, Isaiah spent 2 years talking about how he wasn't going to take a dime less than the max.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That,
and we crushed him for it too. We were some of the only people who were holding his feet to the fire on that and saying like, hey, that's not the world's best move. There's no doubt.
Yeah. And it put Boston in a tough spot where they're sitting there looking at x-rays of his hip and saying, all right, well, we don't want to commit $180 million to somebody who is not going to be able to finish this deal. And with that said, again, Isaiah is perfectly within his rights to be like, look, I went out there 2 days after my sister passed away and played a playoff game for you guys. And a month later, I was in the middle of trade rumors. Like, that's bullshit.
Yeah, and on top of that, don't even worry about the contract side of it. Boston didn't want to be in a position where they had to wait 5 months for Isaiah to get back on the court this season. These guys are trying to build up an Eastern Conference Finals trip. There's no question that trading Isaiah for their short-term outlook, forget about the long-term outlook, for the short-term outlook was significantly better. So I don't really blame Danny for it. I just completely think that Isaiah is right to have whatever resentment he wants. The other thing I'd say about Danny is this whole image of him is, oh, he'd trade his mother, he'll trade anybody. For years and years that builds, right? And then for so long he doesn't make any moves when he could have. And then he does trade the fan base's mother, you know, their beloved mother, Isaiah Thomas. I mean, that is basically like the hardest like knife to the heart that you could ever have. The fact that he actually did it, kudos to Danny. I mean, I have a few Chipotle burritos on me. that was a pretty phenomenal twist. And it look, his team is better. When you watch the Celtics now, I mean, and you're seeing what Kyrie's saying about their ball movement and all of this, their style of play, they are much better off this season and in the future with Kyrie running it than they were with Isaiah.
Yes. And speaking of Kyrie, we did have a quick stop at the coffee shop this week where you sent me these quotes before the podcast. He says,
well, first of all, when I sent them to you, did you think that I made them up or did you think that he actually said them?
No, because I'd seen people talking about it. I'd seen people like joking about it on Twitter. So I knew something happened. And here he says, it's exciting to be back on the East Coast. It's fast paced. A lot of different cultures, food, people. You get it all, especially in Boston. You would go to Cleveland and it would be at night and things would be going on, but you just see a vast difference in Boston. And a difference too, Irving said, in Boston, I'm driving through and thinking, man, I'm really playing in a real live sports city. What was your reaction?
So those quotes are from the Charlotte Observer. And the reason why I asked if you wondered if I had made them up is because that's exactly the type of quote you would make up if you were trying to, one, mock the new Kyrie Irving, but two, stoke fires right before they have to go play Cleveland in the opening game of the season. It's like, if you're a Cavaliers fan, doesn't this just drive you mad? This suggestion that the rival city is so much better, that there's nothing to do in Cleveland, that it's a boring flyover state. I mean, isn't that basically what he's saying?
He is saying that. And can we get something clear? Cleveland is actually pretty cool. So we went through this at the finals 2 years ago. You were trashing Cleveland the whole time we were there. I like Cleveland. It's cooler than you would think. I think part of it is that people come in with low expectations. At least I did. And then I was like, wait a second, there's a city here. Like, there's a lot of people, a lot of decent bars and whatever. And so that's number one. I understand why Kyrie would be pumped to get out of there, but like, it's not like Boston is Manhattan. There's not that much of a difference between downtown Boston and downtown Cleveland, for the record. Second of all, of all the things you could criticize Cleveland for, not being a sports city is like one of the only things that you can't give Cleveland shit about. Like, they are the ultimate sports city.
That's what I'm saying. That's why they have to be going crazy, because he says this on the night the Indians get eliminated from the baseball playoffs. Like, that's pretty rough and tone deaf. I mean, whatever you want to say, you know, I think coffee shop Kyrie sometimes just operates on his own mental plane. He's not concerned about everybody else, and that is going to come back to bite him at some point. I would say Cuyahoga Valley National Park, not bad, not bad at all.
Try to win back Ohio.
But I was also thinking, you know, really, how do I feel about Cleveland? And one problem that I have with Cleveland is not the nightlife. I don't care about that. There are not a lot of vegetarian-friendly food options.
You're right.
easily accessible. And Kyrie has now just become a vegan. He's joined this movement, this wave. And I think he probably just got sick of trying to just eat French fries every single night downtown at the sports bars down there, because that's really pretty much all they serve in that little area right around the stadium. And, you know, if you get out to the suburbs, you know, it's mostly chain restaurants. I could see why something like that, that Boston might have a greater diversity of vegan options. I could see that being a real game changer for him.
That was your complaint about New Orleans also. I'll never forget first night in New Orleans. I'm like, let's go out to eat. You're eating Jimmy John's in New Orleans. That is a crime. But yes, this will be a fun story to track over the next few days leading up to opening night. And hopefully LeBron plays.
I just really don't think he could have put his foot in his mouth anymore if he had tried. And yeah. On top of this, I love that he's kind of got the counter programming going on where he's seeking out fans and giving them his shoes as sort of like his awareness campaign for the new Celtics fans. So he's like building up one flank while also like roasting the other flank of fans. I think it's pretty interesting and calculated. It's going to explode. I mean, this is something that we have to track on this minute level, because it will absolutely fester and explode at some point this season.
Can we play the coffee shop clip real quick?
Please.
Oh, if you're very much woke, there is no such thing as distraction. Oh, if you're very much woke, there is no such thing as distraction.
All right, there we go. Can't wait for coffee shop on opening night. And let's do a couple more questions before the podium. I know you have one podium question that you are really excited about. But first, Greg says, Ben, you defended Patty Mills by saying that Sharp wouldn't be able to dribble past half court while guarded by Mills. Are there any players who Sharp would be able to get by? Isaiah, Kyrie, maybe Boris Diaw. I did think about this. Isaiah and Kyrie, no way. They're way too athletic. It could ruin my life. And look, Boris Diaw, I understand he's an easy target, but Boris was guarding LeBron in the finals, so I don't think he should even be in this conversation. After thinking about it enough, the guy I came up with was Enes Kanter, because
he's fantasy sleeper Enes Kanter.
He is a fantasy sleeper, but that dude just annoys me, and I can't totally explain why. But his whole shtick on Twitter is just, I don't know, he's doing too much. And that's been there for 2 or 3 years. And I think I would be motivated enough to want to make it, to like fight extra hard. And then he's not a great athlete, doesn't seem very interested in defense. I believe in myself against Enes Kanter.
Yeah, I just, because people have said I've been bullying you, I just want to make it clear, like, this was more praising Patty Mills rather than slandering Andrew. I don't know how good Andrew's handle is, but it was mostly about just Patty Mills being up in your jersey. However, the two names that I came up with of guys you could potentially dribble by were actually fairly similar mold to Enes Kanter.
Yeah.
My first pick was Boban.
That's actually a good one.
I think it's mostly a leverage thing. Right. I think there's just really no way for, if you really get low with your dribble, I really don't think that Boban can get low with you. And then I think the other one would be Mozgov, just because I had to watch him play a lot for the Lakers last year and it kind of left scars. And I think it's another similar thing where if you just come off the baseline really hard one direction and maybe like, you know, do a few crossovers, you're going to eventually get that half step you need to get across the midcourt line in 8 seconds. So I have faith that you'd be able to get past at least two, and actually now that you mentioned Kanter, three NBA players.
Yeah, we could also maybe throw in Jahlil Okafor to that mix.
He's vegan now, though. He's vegan now.
That's true. It changes the whole equation. Quite a dream team there. Boban and Kanter. Who is the third guy?
Mozgov.
Mozgov, yeah. Mozgov, starting for the playoff Nets this year. Next question is Jackson. He says, in a potential finals appearance against the Cavs, would the Rockets have a chance? Adding to that, which teams in the West would really have a chance against Cleveland if the Warriors weren't the obvious favorite? So let's say the Warriors don't exist. Who could beat the Cavs?
Right now, I think Houston is a clear-cut second-best all-around team in the NBA. I'm officially in on them.
Okay. Took you a few weeks. You were talking about the Spurs like last week.
Yeah, but Houston, I've been really excited about Houston ever since they got Chris, and it's just really solidified and kind of coagulated, whatever phrase you want to use. I think they match up better, though, with Golden State than Cleveland because they don't have that like designated LeBron stopper that you kind of need. Because Finals LeBron is a different animal. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to have Kawhi, you have to have Iguodala, have some just like A-list perimeter guy who can limit him or wear him down or whatever it might be. So I think LeBron versus the Rockets in the finals could just be like, I mean, numbers that are scary to even contemplate. Like, I don't even want to say them. I mean, I'm talking like 40 points, like 15 assists, like 14 rebounds, like three blocks. Like, finals LeBron against Houston is definitely a fantasy sleeper. But I do think they would not go down without a fight. I mean, I think we cannot say enough about their offensive ceiling. I think it would cause a lot of problems. I think their depth and versatility, lineup-wise, is definitely still underrated. And I think they would pose a lot of problems for Cleveland's just individual defensive players. I mean, there's a lot of guys on Cleveland who you recognize their names, but you don't trust their individual defense or their team defense in like a finals type scenario. Houston will put tons of pressure on those weak links. So I think I might actually take Houston in seven in the finals over Cleveland as currently constructed. But it's really hard to know because of the Isaiah factor, too. If Isaiah is up to speed, you could talk me into taking the Cleveland in that series. But I think Houston deserves all the hype right now.
What about OKC? I agree with most of what you said. I would take the Cavs in that series because of the complete inability to throw anyone at LeBron. And then they also, the thing that has worked against Cleveland in the finals the last few years is that like Love is borderline unplayable. Whereas I feel like you could hide Love easier against the Rockets than you ever could against the Warriors. And throw Love on like Capella or Trevor Ariza and they would be mostly okay. But OKC, I think I would take the Thunder in that series too.
Yeah, I think OKC needs to worry about winning a first round series before we even enter them into this discussion. So that's how I feel.
That's completely fair. But Paul George is a solid LeBron stopper, about as good as you're going to get. And then beyond that, the talent is mostly a wash. I think the big takeaway from this question, though, is how much fun the playoffs would become if the Warriors were somehow removed from the equation. Because there are like four or five teams that are on just about equal footing, and it would be great to watch all those guys go to war.
Yeah, it would also be great if we didn't have to have these hypothetical matchups between Houston and Cleveland. Because we just did a top 1-16, and those guys played in the quote-unquote Eastern Conference Finals, which
is true. How
it would break out.
That's a good point.
So we're banging the drum hard here, Adam Silver. Just keep thinking about it. We see your comments. We appreciate it. 1-16, it's not impossible. Imagine the impossible dream.
Okay. Podium. Benjamin asks, when you talked about your daily routine, Golliver, you mentioned you listened to 3 hours of podcasts a day. Which podcasts do you listen to? Who are your favorites?
You were horrified when I said that, by the way. I could hear it in your voice.
That's too many podcasts for the record, but do you live your best life?
So I have a wide mix here. I got to start with the starters. Those guys are just money every single day. The Daily, New York Times, you know, stay informed.
Okay.
Stay woke, stay very much woke like Kyrie. Love It or Leave It, Pod Save America are also great politics podcasts. They're funnier, but they still keep you kind of up to date. Love It or Leave It is like humor / politics. I mean, John Lovett's one of the funniest people on the planet. Obviously, Simmons and Zach are both great. I also live the NPR lifestyle a little bit, so I get into This American Life, Serial when it's around. But the one I want to really recommend is Slate's Trumpcast. I think it's a little bit below the radar. I'm not totally sure. It's awesome. I mean, I've probably learned more from that podcast than almost any other show I listen to. The best podcast, though, is Open Floor. It's SI's NBA show starring Andrew Sharp. 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. And also, send us emails, openfloormail@gmail.com.
Great, great suggestions across the board. I actually might check a couple of those out. And
oh, I forgot. Breakaway. Rob's podcast is awesome when he's running it. And then for other random ones like MGO Blog for Michigan fans, that their podcast is like super duper nerdy, but they do a good job.
I'm really interested in your life as a diehard Michigan football fan. It's the secret life of Ben Golliver freaking out on Saturday. And yes, condolences about the Michigan State loss. But next question is from Jack. You sent me this question 3 times, so I guess you really wanted me to acknowledge it. Says, man, Andrew straight up stole my idea about how much better a randomized draft lottery would be on the last pod. He even repeated what I said word for word and then paused to think of a different team than the Heat, who I mentioned. And he said, I said, the Nuggets as a team that would have had Lonzo Ball or Markel Fultz. Jack wanted a shout out. So shout out to Jack. I don't think I've definitely stolen various ideas from the open floor emails over the last year or so. I don't think I stole that one. I have been a fan of the randomized draft lottery idea for the last year or two, mainly because I think it's a bummer that guys like Anthony Davis get like jettisoned to these teams that have no idea how to run a basketball team and then like have 6 or 7 or 8 years of their career hijacked. So it's less about a tanking solution and more about like getting players to decent situations. But look, shout out Jack. Great minds think alike.
Yeah, and let's shout out Nas too. No idea is original, you know, as totally. Nas would say. And I think that in these conversations, whether it's lottery reform or tanking or whatever else, like all these things have been in the public sphere for years. We've heard every angle. And we appreciate you guys weighing in. We're not trying to slight anyone. We're certainly not trying to steal your ideas. Although, like you said, there's some accusations of that every once in a while. But shout out, Jack.
Totally. Gray asks, if Utah's 5 national parks were a basketball team, which positions would each park play?
So Gray sent this email, arguably the greatest email we've ever received. And I spent the next 2 hours of my hour of contemplation kind of going through this. And then at the end of the second hour, I realized that you probably wouldn't include it on the podcast. So I just wrote out an email to him with my team. But then you surprised me as if it's like my birthday or something and you put it in. So I really appreciate that.
You left out the best part of that. The email that Ben wrote was like 1,000 words. And then at the end, you said, so who's your squad? And you never heard back.
And Gray hasn't replied yet. Look, he just probably wants to hear it on the podcast. It's okay. It's not like I'm over here anxiously awaiting his email or anything.
All right.
So here's my squad.
Give us
here's my squad.
Cliff notes, like real quick.
Okay. The point guard is going to be Arches. It's kind of the flashy face of the franchise. It's not necessarily the most complete. It might even be kind of a one-trick pony. But the arches are beautiful. Of course, the actual rock arches sort of mimic the three-point shot arc, so you can kind of see where that would go. If you look on Utah's license plates, you'll see arches, and Delicate Arch in particular. That's the point guard. Shooting guard is going to be Bryce. Now, this is really where I got deep, because Bryce is my favorite park in the entire world, and it really pulls on me emotionally, sort of like Michael Jordan does. And so that's really the only thing I can compare it to. I was thinking, you know, Yellowstone is the original classic, sort of like Bill Russell. The Grand Canyon is kind of like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar because it just goes on forever. And I really think Glacier up in Montana is probably LeBron. I mean, it's just so overwhelming and jaw-dropping that you really, if you were going like skill by skill and attribute by attribute, you'd probably say Glacier's the best. But deep down in my heart of hearts, I will always stand out for Bryce as the best. I think the amphitheater, it's just this perfect and everlasting collection of rocks. It reminds me a lot of the 6-0 finals record. Just, it's untouchable. You know, it will never be topped. And then I look at the hoodoos, which are these little rock formations that sort of look like you know, chess pieces. Each one of those really is kind of like a 50-point game, and there's just so many of them in Jordan's vast array of career highlights that kind of just puts it all together, and it becomes just this thing that stuns you. It takes your breath away, and it will stick with you for the rest of your life. Small forward, it's the most complete.
I can't believe we're only on small forward.
Small forward is Zion because it's the most complete, well-rounded, two-way impact. It's famous, recognizable. Everybody knows a small forward. It's the easy go-to for the casual fans. It won't disappoint you. There's all these different facets and layers to its game. You can kind of picture Paul George sort of being like Zion. Power forward is going to be Canyonlands. Now, the key thing about Canyonlands is that it's just close to arches. So its real biggest benefit is location spacing, if you will. And it's also kind of dependent upon arches. Like, if arches didn't exist... Hey, keep it together. I'm being serious here. If arches didn't exist, Canyonlands wouldn't be nearly as worthwhile. So Canyonlands is a stretch four. It's just not really, if standing alone, it wouldn't be as successful. Finally, center would be Capitol Reef. Now, Capitol Reef, much like the modern center, is simultaneously non-essential and overlooked, right? You don't necessarily need a center to win, but we probably underrate how good centers are these days, just the way the game is trending, right? Capitol Reef is beautiful. It's remarkably talented, but it's also esoteric in the middle of nowhere. Most people don't go there. A lot of people will say they've been to all five parks, but they haven't actually been to Capitol Reef. It's also old school. There's this real like barn style feel to it. Very traditional, much like centers we think of as the traditional position. Really, Capitol Reef is just esoteric. I mean, it's kind of like a European guy who gets drafted in the second round, has some name you don't know how to pronounce. He's intriguing. You sort of hear about him, but you never actually experience him. That's my starting five. And I would love to hear anyone's squad. Andrew, do you have a squad?
I don't have a squad. I don't think I've ever in the history of this podcast had that much trouble keeping it together. But I can't believe how serious you were.
It's crazy he hasn't replied to my email. You got to admit that. Like, come on, Gray.
Totally. Get in the game, Gray. No, shout out to you. That was amazing. And honestly, part of me wonders whether you created a burner account to send this email to us. Because it really, I don't think there's ever been a question that checks more of your boxes in terms of things you value, but that was a tremendous performance all around. And we had a couple other questions, but I think we got to just cut it short and cut it at the national parks. There's no way we'll top that today.
That is the high point of my life and this podcast. Andrew, have fun at the baseball game. If the Nationals win, they're going to be staring down at the incredible Los Angeles Dodgers, the future World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers. I look forward to talking all sorts of smack with you about that matchup in the future.
Totally.
Guys.
Two passionate baseball fans here. Hold on. One more thing. The 5 minutes on Ben's starting five of Utah National Parks is all the proof you need that we've had way too much time this preseason and we really need basketball to start. But it's coming next
good.
Week.
You brought it full circle because I complained about it at the start. You brought it full circle. That's why we're pros, man. Everyone's saying you guys got the chemistry and the cohesion down pat this year. I feel it too. I feel it too. That was great. Hey, good. openfloormail@gmail.com for your questions, whether they're national parks related or coffee shop Kyrie related. 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Andrew, the games are coming on Tuesday. I could not be more excited. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.